Welcome to River Styx at Duff's. Tonight we have two poets, both doing what I believe are, in each case, their first reading in St. Louis. Eric Pankey and the poet Antler, who's come down here from Milwaukee. Leading off the evening will be Eric Pankey. We'll take a break after his reading of about 10 minutes, and then we'll come back with the second poet, Antler. Eric Pankey has just recently come to St. Louis to live. He coordinates the writing program at Washington University. He's one of the outstanding young poets in the nation. His first book, which is called For the New Year, received the Walt Whitman Award that's given by the Academy of American Poets, and is a really fine book, the poems I find to be personal, to be experiential, to deal with relationships. He's got a second book in the works that will be out soon. It's called Heartwood, and I hope you'll listen with open ears and give a warm welcome to Eric Pankey.
Well, thank you, Michael. I'm going to start out with a poem.
Ejaculation.
And it's in the form of a letter. My little actress, the frail white birch planted near my favorite seat was split unluckily by lightning. When the storm clouds gathered overhead, the scarlet stars of Pimpernel closed. I watched the two cranes with clipped wings start their odd waltz through the garden and around the imported eucalyptus. Then rain fell, one gray sheet of water smearing my French window. The garden, the row of peach and apricot trees, and the spreading plum with fine red leaves looked like the waste of a ruined orchard. I sat up writing, and the rain dissolved until I could make out the details of the small Japanese trees, the vines, and the avenues of acacias in the receding wind bowed their tips and drew back up again, restless and disconsolate in their movements. The long char on the birch's bleached bark is ugly, a dark, damp glimmering in the last bit of evening light. I am not well here without you. The standard roses are unfortunate in their beauty, the poplars in their size. One of the squawking cranes cannot be found. Someday this stand of trees will seem audience enough, and the slight breeze lifting through the tangle of branches will endure easily, like the sadness or the subtle disappointment felt after good weather or lovemaking. The tree may survive, it's hard to say. Someday, I hope to see you soon. What I decided to do tonight is to read poems that I didn't read when I read at Washington University, since I figured two or three people would be here from there. So I decided to do something, I guess, that might be a little risky, and that is to read mostly love poems, which I hope that poem was, are poems of elegy, which I guess are a kind of love poem as well. So the second poem is an elegy to my father called Tornado Weather. This evening in the settling dark, in what my father called tornado weather, I watched the heat lift its shimmering weight above the snapdragons and low sumac into what light remains inside the maple. Those long nights while I was up, sick, heavy with heat and dreams, I was sure it was my father's broad palm pressed against my forehead that held the fever in. I am no better without him. If the dark brings with it relief, a chill, it's a trick, weather stirring up its storm. June bugs rattle the screen, annoying as ever, like the song he murmured that would not let me sleep. This is a poem called Natural History. It's in two parts. And I think instead of reading numbers, I'll just pause between the two sections. And it takes place in a Missouri landscape. I grew up in Kansas City, but behind our house was a field that I don't think the developers have gotten to yet. And so it was our wild place where we roamed around. Natural history. Light settled in slowly like silt in a choked off creek bed until morning. Time passed like that. After a long hunt for fossils in the scarped and silvery clay of the bank, my brother couldn't decide if the chipped finger-length stone we'd found were the remains of marsh grass or the spines of extinct fish that lived so deep they were their own source of light. But everything, he told me again and again, was turned in time to calcium. Pith or marrow, it didn't matter. He knew such truths. He knew that the sinkhole collared in black moss where we sat listening to the deep waters echo hollow into the distance might have been the bottom of the ocean. He knew that the rise our house was built on might have been a tidal island or a reef. He knew that after the water receded, there was ice, and that wasn't the end of things. That's years ago, he told me, before you can imagine. Summer nights, the grass not yet damp, we lay on our back and let the world, everything that held us down, take us with it. The sky, each star locked in place, turning. The heavens, we called it. A machine we dreamed we invented, so fragile it might break at our touch. One night after a week knotted with high winds, tornadoes, we watched the clouds pile up, the known dark above us collapsed into blackness. We believed God was up there, hidden. The rain broke so suddenly, we were soaked before we could get to our feet. Quick with lightning, the rain and night flashed a moment of white. That's what God looks like, my brother said as we made our way to the porch. Just like that. Another stroke, backed by thunder, halved the changing dark. We laughed uneasy, our eyes blinded, as if we had seen him, just like that. Debtor of happiness. Whatever empties the feeder comes and goes without my knowing. There's little satisfaction in their names or the songs I've stopped listening for. The birds that come, come in spite of me, are welcome to rule the yard and its one tree, to scavenge and pick among the little I've left them. I stood among them once. The morning after Halloween, I broke open a frozen pumpkin against the trunk of the maple. And chickadees and cardinals and even a cedar waxwing cleaned out the three jagged fragments of their hard white seeds. Once I walked along a river's marshy bank, pulling a canoe through the shallows, and all the sounds were water sounds. The reed swayed by wind, the wet call of a killdeer, the heron's blue stealth. Above the quick-cut bank, sparrows broke the air into flight like rain. I believe the birds no longer sing their one song of alliance. If the hummingbird works its way through the damp dust of evening, if the black sweep of a crow's wing or the jay's miserable crying sends the other birds scattering, I am unaware. I feel the earth's pull and cannot look up to see the nest and the winter limbs or the hawk circle its hunger above the rain-washed riverbeds. Now in my dreams, if I fly, flight is more like a falling. I used to wake to their songs once. I would listen and I would hear. It was that simple. What I heard wove a wreath in the air, and I lived beneath it like a happy man, as if there were nothing, nothing but air. Well, the next poem is called Ode to Forgetfulness. And in many ways, it's a self-mocking poem because I tend to be one of those poets who could just keep writing if I just kept saying, I remember this, and I remember that, and I remember this. And, you know, everything happened, and so you can just keep remembering it. This will be the first time I think I've ever read it aloud in public. And it looks sort of big and baggagey on the page, so I'm nervous about it. The lines are a little longer than I let them go usually. Ode to Forgetfulness. You do not have to remember everything. If you should believe that in the room where you grew up, the curtains were always drawn, and if you went back and found no curtains, only blinds, the frayed little noose hooked around a thumbtack, if you should confuse thirst with joy, if you should call the taste of salt bitter when it is sweet, like the wind in the tired shoulders of water, and if you spoke sweetly to your love and gave her winter-blooming jasmine and took nothing, what then? Should we pity you? Remember how easy it was to remember before you were distracted by news of torture, frost on the inside of the storm windows, the names you might name a cat or a dog if you had one. One day you remember seeing your parents making love when all you wanted to ask was permission to cross the street. One day the look on their faces is one of exhaustion. Then it is not a look at all, but a smell, old and damp like straw thrown down. They said to you, fine. On the road all fall, the rolled hay bales steam, burn slowly with their own heat. Like hunger, you think, but know it's not right. You remember how barns always seem on the verge of collapsing. To what can you compare your forgetfulness? It is not a symptom of regret, a crime. Both your brother and sister had collapsed lungs. You're next, you tell yourself, but imagine something worse and irremediable. Not slow, wheezing breaths, but a sudden panic because you cannot remember the road you're on or the name of that mat of mown, dried grass that chokes out even the weeds and grows thicker with their remains. This is a poem that takes place in Columbia, Missouri, of all places. It's a true story, as they say. It's called For Luck, and it's mostly a stolen poem, just a conversation I had with a friend of mine where he told the story, and I counted syllables or something and broke lines, and here's the poem. For Luck. You know for sure you are lucky. Luck fills you like the shape of your breath. Then one day as you are reading it leaves. It lifts up like the shadow of wings with a clean ease of smoke on a cold day. Your luck is gone. You watch it fly away over the tracks beyond Providence Road until it is out of sight. Your luck is gone. Still somehow you trust tenderness and all its romance, the fine caress, the salt on your hands wearing away whatever they touch. Maybe your luck returned. That was not part of the story. If I should die, you said in the prayer you said each night, if I should die before I wake. Was it this morning you woke and listened again to the bent apple tree, to the wind work the sweet ache of its load, to the wren and the air it shivered through? Luck, like hope, is hollow-boned. Always there is an updraft to carry what it can. What it cannot falls upon your head like a blessing. Two more poems. One's very short, the other one's longish. This is called The Gardener. What can he do if good intent is his virtue? What can he do if between the apologies and the thank yous, between the giving, oh giving, and his inextinguishable propensity to respond, "No, please, after you, there is a flaw." He stands in the garden and thinks, as he always does, of that first garden. The tumbled morning glories are shrouded, bound up in a mess of spider webs. The spider's nowhere to be found. The peonies sag a little, their leaves worn red at the edges. He considers the word misery and the word grief, and wonders what deep-cut furrow separates them. He is happy. He knows it. All his friends say of him as if it were the truth. He's at home in the garden, which he takes to mean the world. This last piece is called Variations on the Origin of Blue. It's a poem in 7 parts. Each part is titled. And it's dedicated to my wife, Jennifer. And I say that only because the last section plays with the name Jennifer a little bit. We'll see if it works or not. 1. In your quiet. If in your quiet I was reminded of the imperfect blue of those 2 cobalt rose water bottles set on the weathered sill, set there for nothing but their imperfect blue. If in your quiet I was reminded how slow the moon moves through each of its fractions, the moon over the parsley, over the earth at whose mineral center an agile blue burns, I could not love your absolute shyness more. And when I hear you speak, I hear how final words are. I hear the thinness of pine needles, patient carbon as old as a rain-soaked road, a voice as fine as flowers spread out quick with your palm. I hear everything as if it were the truth. 2. With your step. With your step, starlings startle into a turning, their triangular shapes moving as one spiral until it stalls and drops whole like a sail gone slack, caught beneath the water's surface. It is not dance or purposeful, this walk of yours. Foxtail, foxglove, across a field left untended, left to itself, you step the step that sends the feeding birds scattering, and always to your surprise, your amazement. It is not flight I think of when I watch you move, but how lucky that beneath each of our steps, sure or uncertain as they might be, the falling curve of the earth rises to meet our step. On all sides, the sky, with its share of birds, its clockwork of dawns, its blue which defines water, the sky lingers over us. Your love of the color blue. This day, as heavy as clay, prepares itself for the heat that follows morning. I walk beneath a row of ginkgos without you. I cannot help but think how your hands must hold our child, whose hands are as small as the largest of these leaves. Your love of the color blue cannot be fulfilled today. Their green is cooled by the damp odor of clay, a gray born beneath the soil before there was sky. 4. The simple thing. What I meant to say is that the ginkgo leaves are the oldest yellow. Whatever turns those fans green in this light is not gentian blue, blue of delphinium, white of winter bloom, of witch hazel, or the red of wild berry canes. These words are only a smear, a wreck, of the simple thing I meant to say. Your quiet, the ease with which you hold our child as if she were still a part of the small weight of your body, the way you move, each shares the certain calm of water, that waveless stillness over the site where a ship has gone down. 5. The allegory of the shipwreck. Even the wood of a shipwreck floats, the underside black and barnacled, The salt leached out whitens the split grain of the side we'd see if we were there riding the encumbered blue terrain of water. The rise and fall does not disturb the plank's level ride. Up, down, it bobs, but holds the intersection of longitude and latitude. As in that trick where the tablecloth is pulled out beneath the silver and crystal and everything remains unbroken, the bone china shimmering like bells, what held things up still holds them steady. 6. Your hands. Their whiteness is like trampled mint, the origin of blue, the wind inside a well, the vacant air between lightning and thunder. I wait for the ceremony of your hands, how they cool against my fever, how you hold them closed beneath your breast in fear and in sleep. Every touch is like a promise or a secret kept. The thistle wears its purple crown day and night, but its beauty I would not touch. You walk right up to the flower and hold its unretainable shape. And finally, your name. I think of junipers, of non-deciduous blueness, that ancestor of flowering. Silver, not of mineral, but of the roots of rainfall, a storehouse of blueness, that blue of juniper. It is not to mislead that I exaggerate. I say this with the love and the glad solemnity of the truly faithful, with a penitent's hope. Thank you.
We're going to persuade Eric to come up and read a few more.
I'm actually reminded of when I was in high school, we used to go to these, whoops, how did I manage that? I need that. There we go. We used to go to these concerts a lot when I was in high school and do whatever was illegal at that time. And there would be two bands, and you would always clap and bring out the first band, but you really didn't want to, you know, you wanted to hear the real act. But it was a kind of politeness, I think. But thank you. I hadn't really thought to do this, so I'll read a poem that the River Styx magazine is going to publish that they just took recently. And I don't think he's here, but a man at Washington University, David Haddis, gave me the idea for this poem. He is. Anyway, so, you know, if it's any good, it could be dedicated to him. If it's terrible, I'm sorry, David. It's called Neighbor. Although the good seed was sown in the field, a neighbor came at night and sowed weeds. Still among the ragged stalks of thistle, among the stinging nettle, corn grew. At harvest time, weeds were gathered first. The reapers pulled them up by the roots. They bound the still green weeds in bundles with worn rope, and in a fallow field burned each bundle separately. Black smoke filled the sky for days. When the harvest was complete and the granary full, alive with the faint scratching of mice, the smoke still hung in the windless air. The neighbor shook out his sheets morning and night. Still the oily ash clung hard. It settled on his plate, his table, the whitewashed walls of his house. When he stood at his doorway, gritting his teeth, he could taste the bitter abrasive on his tongue, feel it burning his eyes. He stole corn from the granary, made a strong whiskey to warm his winter. It tasted of ash, as did the snow, which he melted for water and drank when he woke at night with a terrible thirst. little morality tale there. This is terrible. Now I'm not prepared. We'll go with certain things. Read a poem that I did read at Washington University called Crab Apple. The thin chipped branches of the crab apples are as hard as anything that holds on beneath the iron cast of the late autumn sky. Whoever planted them as ornament must have loved the scattered nest, the broken knuckled look of the thing, must have loved the fruit, the ripe, the unripe, pithy white, the dusty red, some speckled with mold, some pecked but not eaten, the holes edged with black, black like charred paper. If the trees are bent, it is not from fruit. Each year they shrink a little, the ground beneath them goes soft with rot, the bark grays like shale. You can only eat so much sour jam, and when you do, you are left with the cramped, twisted look of the tree, a look so jagged, you almost forget the season they flower. And I'll read one more poem, and then we can all have a beverage or something. This is an elegy. I was hoping to end on love, but I'll end on love for the dead, I guess. A poem from my father called Forfeiting Light, which is actually the first poem that was written for my new book that is coming out in the near future, as it was mentioned. The hillside's red sumac, a few thinning maples, so many trees lit up whole beneath the evening's light. How long can the moon stay low like that, mildewed, cold? Its greenish burns on both my hands surprises me. Glowing phosphorescent on a birch or white oak, in a thicket's shadow, lichen could easily be mistaken for a ghost, a spirit that returns because I expect it to. It is October. Below the ridge, my car idles. The exhaust warmth burnishes the asphalt a slick blue black that fades like my father's breath years ago, damp against the mirror as I watched him shaving. It was our time alone. I always thought someone climbing the oak across the mown field from our house could see us there. A boy's face white with shaving cream, a tired man splashing hot water on his face, steam lifting from his hands. Those hands touching his face, the moon forfeiting light to the workday morning, my father not paying attention as I played. I believe that someone, real or spirit, would watch from that tree over me. Now, 6 months since he's gone, in a season in love with death, I have stopped here beside these ragged woods. Lee Ho was right. The trees do fill the four seasons with sadness. I am at home here, where what is lost is loved. Thank you.